well, from the theory of everything to the slightly more mundane. I did my Bachelor of Mathematics degree here at the University of Waterloo, so I always enjoy coming back to this city. It's so nice. And big traffic jam this morning coming from the hotel. I had to stop at two red lights.
That's because you went on the 401.
Yes, I've learned that, yeah. So I'm going to start with a little description of what the National Research Council is. And this is one of our official blurbs. So you can see the budget is about $1 billion annually from the federal government, of which 270 is immediately dispersed to small businesses to support their research programs. There are institutes across Canada in every province. The little red squares represent that. And apparently the new unit of area is now the NHL hockey rink. I didn't know that. I knew the unit of volume is Olympic-sized swimming pools.
We're redefining the SI too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's right. Yeah. And so these are some of the labs. And so the people on the West Coast are the astronomers, whereas in Ottawa, we do a bigger range of things, quantum photonics and metrology in particular. And I was looking at Google Maps. This is the University of Waterloo campus. So you can see the Dana Porter Arts Library and the IQC over here. But look what appeared here. I think there's somebody stuck in NRC building in the middle. It is, according to the campus map, it's nothing to do with NRC. It's the co-op program, but somebody broke into Google. So here's the NRC Ottawa campus, Montreal Road. It's largely a suburban campus, although the city is moved around it. And there's a Canadian Photonics Fabrication Facility here and the National Science Library. And way back here is Building M36, where the metrology work is done. There's a variety of wind tunnels and other things on this campus. I'm located at the original NRC building, which is all by itself on Sussex Drive in Ottawa. It's this building here on Sussex, so the Ottawa River and the Rideau River meet there. So it's kind of a nice location, but science doesn't fit on Sussex Drive because we've got the British High Commission is here, 24 Sussex Drive, and the Gunver Generals is down the street, the U.S. Embassy's on the left. So we're definitely not fit to be on that street. This is a picture from like 1932 when they constructed the building, and it really hasn't changed all that much. There's a Union Jack there. That's the only thing I see Duncan is saluting here. It's surprisingly, when they built it in 1932, of course, they didn't know much about lasers back then, but it's a surprisingly good building for optical facilities. So we have labs down at the lowest level down here, and they're really quite surprisingly stable. Okay, so now change of topic. I was asked to talk about what I do, some of my science, and so it's called attosecond science now. So what happens on different time scales, so this is the scale of time. So with the camera, you can record things on this sort of time scale. So 150 years ago, Edward Muybridge famously took pictures of galloping horses in Stanford with individual cameras, one after another, that surprisingly had a millisecond, one one-thousandth of a second shutter time. Even in those days, it was surprisingly fast. But eventually mechanical shutters are not fast enough to record fast motion. And so Doc Edgerton came up with the xenon flash lamp that illuminated the scene. So instead of having the shutter defining your time resolution, it was the flash of light that defined the time resolution. But around a nanosecond, you have trouble, even with electro-optic cameras, in going faster. And so we then have femtosecond lasers now that enable us to get another six orders of magnitude in time resolution. So now on the timescale of picoseconds, this is the timescale at which molecules rotate. And on the timescale of, say, 100 femtoseconds, the molecules vibrate. And chemical reactions are actually slower than a femtosecond. But again, you can measure these sort of fast things on that timescale with femtosecond lasers. So beyond that, now we have to get into the attosecond regime. And so an attosecond is 10 to the minus 18 seconds. And so now we're looking at basically electrons, the motion of electrons within atoms and molecules. And so the atomic unit of time is 160 attoseconds here. And this is the period of an electron, a classical electron going around a hydrogen atom. And so we have sources that are shorter than this. And so one can resolve basically any electron things. For example, electron rearrangement within an atom. If you remove or excite an electron, within about 100 attoseconds, all the other electrons have realized that something has changed and they rearrange themselves. So this is what we see on that timescale. It's a long way to go down to the Planck timescale yet.
You have some ways to go.
Yeah. Well, you gotta have some ambition, you know. I realize when I give these talks that I use the word pulse a lot, and this is part of our field, I guess, in laser physics, that we always have pulses of light, and it gets tiring to say that again. A light pulse is composed of a carrier frequency and an envelope. And the carrier frequency determines the color, obviously. So I've used a visible wavelength here with a period of a few femtoseconds, and then an envelope of about three femtoseconds. So let's say I want a one femtosecond pulse with the same laser. So now my envelope has to be much shorter. And you can see that now there's a DC component to this electric field. And this field will no longer propagate in vacuum, according to Maxwell's equations. And so there's a limit to how short a pulse can be when I are using visible wavelength. So obviously the solution is to use a shorter wavelength, and then I can get more cycles within this shorter envelope. And so this necessarily means that I can no longer use visible wavelengths to make short pulses less than a femtosecond in duration. I have to go to the extreme ultraviolet or soft X-ray range in order to get these very short pulse durations. So here is an electric field. So it has the envelope, as I mentioned before, and a carrier frequency, and it has an intensity associated with the peak electric field. And so this is my fancy animation of an electron in this field, and it simply wiggles in the field parallel to the polarization direction of the light, and at the end of the pulse, it's stationary again. If you have relativistic intensities, it actually does go in the forward direction, as I showed, because it does absorb photons. But in the lower intensity case, which is what we deal with most of the time, it's simply a motion parallel to the electric field. And so this is how a laser field interacts with a charged particle. So now let's put a proton here. Let's make a hydrogen atom. And so now I have a potential. So the potential is minus 1 over R. Now, we use atomic units, so the charge on the electron and the mass of the electron and Planck's constant are all 1, which make things easier. And I imagine you guys have a different unit where it's C is 1, I would guess. And yeah. So it's, anyway.
Schrödinger units are wrong.
What's that?
All those units are wrong.
I see. And so as I apply this electric field, this the electric field times the potential in the Hamiltonian, in the length gauge, is simply this. And what it does is tilt the plane, tilt the playing field, so to speak. And so you can see if you have a wave function that's bound in here somewhere, that eventually if you tilt it far enough, this wave function can tunnel out. And so here's a 2D picture of the same potential. And so I have here, let's say this is the bound state here. This is the wave function representing this bound state on there. If I apply this field in this direction here, it's going to depress this barrier. So this minus one over R barrier now goes this direction. And so you can imagine that this wave function will be able to tunnel through. And if your intensity is high enough, then this actually becomes a classically allowed thing. And this you have over the barrier ionization. But typically intensities, the atom is already ionized by the time the intensity gets that high. So here's a movie of time-dependent Schrodinger equation calculation for a hydrogen atom. So the atom is sitting here. Well, actually, you don't see the atom. You see the wave function of the electron in the atom. And the intensity represents the square of the wave function. And the color represents the phase of the wave function. And this movie is going to take place over one optical cycle in time. So the field is in this direction. And you're going to see the wave function tunneling out and then coming back again. And in atomic units, this is 150 atomic units. So that's, what's an atomic unit? Half an angstrom or two angstroms?
One board radius?
Yeah.
One angstrom.
Okay. There's a factor of two there, but I don't know. I never remember which way. It's either two or a half. So what's happening is the field now. So this is the phase evolving in time because it is negative energy. But you can start seeing the wave function now tunneling out to the right as the field pulls it out. So this is what we would call tunnel ionization, and this wave function slowly moves to the right. And you can see it's got a wave property because the phase is varying across it. And it's also spreading laterally, so it's spreading up and down. And part of it's gonna disappear. Now what you see here on the left is this big circle is forming, and this is kind of a watershed, and everything to the left of it now is going to the left. And so these are electron trajectories which are now going back again. So the field has changed direction, and all of this stuff here is now moving right to left, and it's re-encountering the hydrogen atom that it started from. And this stuff here is ionization on the second half cycle. So now the field pushed the population here, then the field changed direction on this timescale here, and drove a lot of it back again. And on the next half cycle, it's starting to repeat on the other direction. Now, the point to notice here is that this wave is spread out over 150 Bohr or so. So it's very much like a plane wave. And I don't know if you noticed, but the wavelength, the separation between here is different than it is there. So it actually chirps up in frequency, the kinetic energy. That's right. Yeah, and so if you are sitting on this atom here, you will see the wave function going away, but then you'll see it coming back again and increasing in kinetic energy and looking very much like a plane wave.
So it bothers me this is two-dimensional. It should really be three.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's hard to draw things in three dimensions. There is cylindrical symmetry on this. We're not losing any information.
Calculation 2D?
It's a 2D calculation. I just did this in MATLAB, so it's not... But yes, drawing higher dimensional stuff is quite challenging, and I think our brains are limited to 2D for some reason. That's why we have blackboards. So here's the picture again. So so classically what I'm doing is I've got, let's say, a proton, an electron, an intense field. Remember, this electron wants to do this in the laser field, so it gets pulled away and gets driven back when the field changes direction, and it re-encounters the ion, the proton. So it can do three things. It can scatter elastically, which is the most likely thing. It can scatter inelastically if there's another electron in the system, so it can exchange energy. And the most unlikely thing is that it can recombine, photo-recombine. So it's picked up energy in the field. It can recombine back to where it started from. And what does it do with all this extra kinetic energy? It converts it to a single photon, and so it can emit a photon. So this is maybe 10 to the minus 6 probability of this photo recombination, but it's responsible for what we call high harmonic generation. And so it's the only cause of emission of energetic photons from this sort of system. Yeah, the Schrodinger equation has everything. So it has all of the... it does, yes, not directly. So in Schrodinger's equation, there is no creation of photons as such. Of course, you could formulate it in that way. But the way Schrodinger's equation accounts for emission is an oscillating dipole. And so as this plane wave comes over the bound state, so there's one electron, but it's in two places at the same time. So most of it actually remains in the atom. And some of it goes away and comes back again with more energy. And it's this when you add these two parts of the same wave function, you'll see the expectation value of the position is oscillating. And it oscillates at the energy difference. And so it's this sort of a classical antenna which radiates an electromagnetic field. So that's actually how we calculate it here. Yes. Yes. Yeah, well, the acceleration, actually. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. But there's...
It gives good enough answer, actually. It gives good enough answer if you estimate, stuff.
But if you want to see things actually happen.
Yeah. No, I mean, you could use, second quantization or QED if you want. It just gets more complicated. So certainly this is what people use because it works.
How do you get a single photon coming out here?
That's a good question. Yes, I think you would. Again, it's the difference between a photon picture and a wave picture.
Yeah, just
because
it depends on the intensity of the light emitted, right? So if you have an oscillating dipole, you can estimate how much flux you get from that.
No, but I think if you create a photon, then you only get one, I would guess. You don't know when. Whereas when you do it this way, all possible things occur at the same time. And so I can create a low energy photon early, or I can create a high energy photon late, and it happens all at once. Oh yeah, yeah. I'll get to that. So I think I'm just summarizing here what this three-step model is, so the field depresses the potential that holds the electron in place. And so the electron, or part of the electron wave function, goes to the right until the field changes direction. And then it comes back, but it's picked up kinetic energy. And so now it is superimposed. So this is where your different pictures are. So you could have a photo recombination. So you lose energy in the electron and gain it in the photon, by creating a photon. You look at it as the acceleration of the charge. And what this results in is each half cycle, this repeats of the field. And so I get a little burst of radiation in each half cycle. with alternating phase. And so this is an attosecond pulse train. And so each pulse is shorter than the half cycle, and it repeats. And so if I were now to take this emission and put it on a spectrometer in the lab, so now I've got in the EV range now, so this is the extreme ultraviolet range, it can be seen that it's odd integer multiples of the driving laser field. And this is just due to the periodicity. So I've converted basically an optical photon of 1.5 electron volts, and I've created now a series of pulses with energy up to about 80 electron volts.
So the drive here, the driving pulse is the very well defined curves.
So it's the red. It's the red.
Oh, it's the red.
The red are the odd multiples of the 1.5 EV.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you make a high frequency comes out of this?
Yeah, we'll come to that too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of intertwined. So I'll talk about frequency combs in a bit. So this is another calculation of what the emission looks like, the electric field of the emitted light. And so I've got a train of pulses. So what if I just want one attosecond pulse? So I make my laser pulse, the red one, shorter in time. And so one uses a bunch of techniques in order to reduce the duration of the pulse down to about 4 or 5 femtoseconds. I've still got two bursts here of attosecond emission, and I only want one. And so the only difference between the upper and the lower ones is the phase of the laser field. And so it's basically a cosine field on the top and a sine field on the bottom. And again, this is related to frequency combs, is that the technology now exists that we can control the phase of the carrier underneath the envelope here. So I can control with optical things, I can control the shape of the red pulse, and I can end up with a single attosecond pulse. And this is a measured attosecond pulse from over 10 years ago. So it was measured to be 135 attoseconds. So you can see now the time scale is now attoseconds rather than femtoseconds, and indeed they're down to I think about 70 attoseconds right now. And so in the last couple of decades, there's been quite a revolution in getting shorter and shorter optical pulses from these laser systems. So if this is the pulse duration here, so this is that's picosecond there. In the early days of lasers, and it got shorter and shorter as they developed mode locking and so on techniques. And then nothing happened for 15 or so years until attosecond pulses came around year 2000. And now it's gone down. We're down below the axis now on this sort of thing. So it's always nice to see progress in some fields.
Why does the graph end before?
Say again.
Why does the graph end before 2010?
Oh, this was published in that. This is what.
Where are you now?
Well, we're, as I say, single attosecond pulse is somewhere down here, I guess. So in a way, we're flattening out too.
Well, you can't do much about the. I mean, as you mentioned, the Bohr orbit is 100 attoseconds. So electrons falling back into this well and sloshing around, and that's the time scale. You're not going to get it shorter than that.
I'd have to think about that. I wonder if that is a fundamental limit. It could be. So this is what our lab looks like at Sussex Drive. And as I mentioned, it's really nicely designed. It's one thing NRC is good at, is designing good labs. And so we have the laser systems inside a laser room here. And then the end stations here, the beam lines where we do the experiments are outside. And so this is me pretending to be looking into a Thai sapphire laser system. And this is what one of the beam lines or end stations look like. It's in vacuum because if it, when we take these high intensity laser pulses, if we focus them in air, we just get a nice spark, a nice plasma, which is very satisfying, but it doesn't help you do experiments. And also the emission that we produce, I showed 80 electron volts, and that's of course ionizing radiation. So any gas will simply photoionize with that radiation. So it has to be transported in vacuum also. So this is a cutaway picture of the experiment. So I have a gas source here. This is a pulsed valve. So we just for vacuum pump reasons, we have a little pulse of gas that goes into the vacuum chamber, synchronized with the laser pulse, which comes in through a window and focuses into this. And so all of this stuff that I mentioned, this three-step model, which leads to the emission of the photons. Now this, what I didn't mention is this is a coherent process. And so every atom, even though it has a different quantum phase to start with, because it starts and ends with the same wave function, it doesn't care what the initial phase is. So every atom is emitting this electromagnetic radiation coherently. And so I focus it into a small beam in my gas jet, and all these atoms are creating this nice train of attosecond pulses, or a single attosecond pulse, coherently. So it's very much like a laser source. So it has coherence, it's collimated in the forward direction. In fact, it's even more collimated than the incoming laser.
How many atoms do you use?
We'd like to get as high pressure as we can without killing the vacuum pumps, but it would typically be somewhat less than an atmospheric pressure, which is So it would be 10 to the 19 per cubic centimeter is atmospheric pressure, right? And
how big is your beam?
Let's say 50 micron diameter, and let's say less than a millimeter in length. So there's many atoms there, I would say, but 10 to the 16, I don't know. I'd have to pull up my calculator. And what is that in Olympic swimming pools? I don't know. So this extreme ultraviolet radiation then emanates into another chamber where we can do experiments. Here we've got a grating spectrometer, so we simply disperse the spectrum, and this is what we see on the microchannel plate detector here. So it's got these odd multiples. This is the 15th harmonic of my 1.5 electron volt carrier frequency of my titanium sapphire laser, up to about 60 electron volts. And so it's got very nice spatial properties and so on. And so there's different things we can do with this. So we can use this radiation in a second chamber to do photoionization experiments. This is really a nice way to photoionize. So we can remove an electron from a molecule, for example, and with very good time resolution, so we can tell whether the molecule is like this or like that, for example. So we call molecular frame photoionization experiments. Or we can actually do the experiment in the gas jet here, which is what I'm going to talk about next. So now the gas you have, up to now I've talked about hydrogen atoms because they're easy to understand. But this process, the three-step process, I remove an electron through tunnel ionization, I bring it back, and I photorecombine. This photorecombination is mediated by a transition dipole matrix element between effectively a plane wave in the continuum and a bound state. And so the shape of the bound state wave function is going to play a role in this probability of this photo recombination. And so here is an argon sample, and it does not have that smooth spectrum I showed before. You can see these harmonic orders that I mentioned, but there's a huge dip down here at around 50 electron volts. And that didn't show up in the other calculations that I showed earlier. So this is the well-known Cooper minimum in argon photoionization. So this is basically from a synchrotron experiment where they put argon atoms in a synchrotron beam, in a soft X-ray synchrotron beam. They change the frequency of the synchrotron through a monochromator and measure the photoionization cross-section. And there's a big minimum, around 50 electron volts in photoionization. And that is exactly what we see here. And so one would argue this is simply time reversal. So photoionization, I come in with a 50 electron volt photon to my argon atom. The system is photoionized and produces a photoelectron associated with that. But the matrix element for this photoionization process, a transition from a 2p, 3p ground state valence electron of argon to the continuum, has a minimum. And that's it's just in the quantum mechanics of it. So we're doing the opposite now. We're coming in with this electron with this 50 electron volts of kinetic energy, and it wants to photo recombine, but the matrix element is small at that region. And so in a way, this shows this is photo ionization in reverse. And so we use that for other stuff. So here's the expectation value. This is the transition dipole between a bound state of the system and the system with one electron missing and the electron with momentum K in the continuum. When we do argon gas, xenon gas, this was a bit surprising. So we had to use a longer laser wavelength in order to get our photon energy out to about 150 electron volts. So this was some laser work involved in this. So you'd think, oh, this is the Cooper minimum that he was talking about. Well, what's interesting here is this big bump at 100 electron volts. And this is known in the photoionization community as the giant plasma residence in xenon. And it's not really well understood exactly what it is, because there's xenon, the valence shell is a 5p. And my laser field can only remove a valence electron. I didn't mention it, but this tunnel ionization is very sensitive to only the most weakly bound electrons of the system. This giant resonance, 100 eV, is associated with a 4D shell, which has, I think, 10 electrons, but there's 70 electron volts more deeply bound than the valence electron. And so there's no way my laser field is going to pull out one of those electrons. And yet somehow they're implicated in this curve. So the blue curve is our experiment of the spectrum emitted by this xenon sample. The symbols are photoionization cross-section measurements done at a synchrotron facility. And so each one is a very slow process. You can see they don't have a lot of symbols on this because they have to redo the monochromator and do a measurement again, and then their beam time is up. But there was a lot of surprise when this is an electron-electron interaction, basically. But what's surprising is that we can time reverse this. So we take a 5p electron away, it goes away, comes back. So the normal process is that I have to return to the 5p hole. I have to return to the initial state. But that has a weak transition moment. However, you can have an electron exchange. So quantum mechanically, you can always do that because they're identical particles. You can always swap these particles, and suddenly you now have a hole in the 4D shell, and you can recombine to that. And so you get the much bigger cross-section. So what was surprising here was that the time reverse process works too. And my theoretical friends just shrug and they say, well, of course. But as an experimentalist, it is surprising.
So that graph is of the time reverse.
This the blue one is the photo recombination cross section, and the green one is the theoretical calculation based on all this electron exchange stuff in the photoionization.
At high frequencies, you had trouble with the laser. At low frequencies, why doesn't it match there?
Oh, I thought it was a pretty good match. I think basically we just.
Error bars are.
Yeah. Oh, well, we don't have error bars. these guys have error bars. They have to worry about everything. I think basically we're just running out of spectrum here, because if I put in a different atom, for example, it would also fall off here. So if we had maybe a longer wavelength. So ironically, we have to go to longer wavelengths with a laser source in order to get higher photon energies. It sort of sounds backwards, but that's the way it is. Well, the cutoff here, the highest frequency scales as the intensity of the laser times the wavelength squared. And we're limited to the intensity because we totally strip the atom if we go to too high intensity. And so that leaves you with the wavelength as the scaling thing. So people are going to as much as 4 microns now to produce. So I mean, these sources now go out to the carbon K edge, which is of great interest in imaging stuff because of it's in the water window where between carbon and oxygen absorption. And so people use these sources now to measure near edge structure on the carbon K edge in samples.
Can I think of it as the distance over which you're accelerating the electron is longer, so you get more energy?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is, yeah. So the period is longer for the longer wavelength. So instead of doing this trajectory, I'm doing this trajectory. And so it picks up more from the field. Okay, so now I'm doing another experiment here in bromine. So I've been saying that femtoseconds is the time scale at which molecules vibrate and there's chemical reactions going to occur. And bromine is nasty to do experiments with because it messes up your vacuum pumps, among other things. Didn't kill any grad students. But the nice thing is it absorbs 400 nanometers. So that's blue light. And it's easy to produce blue light at 400 nanometers when your laser is 800 nanometers from the Thai sapphire. It's just a single crystal. And so we can do a photo excitation from the ground state. So I'm used to showing these things, but perhaps I should explain. So this is energy. This is a potential energy curve versus internuclear separation between the two bromine atoms. And this is the energy of the eigenstate, the lowest energy eigenstate of the system. And so it's going to sit at the bottom here, the molecule, and it can actually vibrate in this well here, but it's the bound state. But if I absorb 400 nanometer photon, I get to this excited electronic state, which is repulsive. So the ball is effectively going to roll down the hill. So I absorb the 400 photon, and the molecule will come apart. And so this is a nice, it's called unimolecular decay or dissociation. And so it's a simple one to test. But now we have time involved in this. And so the only way to do these experiments is called pump probe measurements. And so this is a bit like the photograph that Edward Muybridge had of the horses. And the pump was somebody saying to the horse, start running. And the probe is when the shutter opened on the camera. And so here our pump is 400 nanometers and the probe is the high harmonic generation produced by 800 nanometers. And so now we are doing high harmonics in a system which is composed of both a ground state and an excited state as it dissociates. And we wanted to see, can we follow this dissociation?
When you hit the bromine with the laser, do you ionize one electron? What do you do?
Well, the 400 nanometers does not ionize. It only excites, so it's much weaker.
See, what's the red curve on the plot?
This one here?
Yeah,
that's the B state, I think it is. So what happens is, well, I've kind of drawn here what the orbital looks like here. So this is a single electron orbital. And so that is it's forming a bond. When I add energy and go to another eigenstate, it's now antibonding. And so this electron orbital will tend to push the molecule apart. So I'm only rearranging one electron in the system. But then I come along with the other more intense laser and I remove probably this electron here. And that's the one that produces the light. that we see. And it's a bit lengthy to get into this, but so this is the time delay in picoseconds for some reason, we should have done femtoseconds, of between the 400 nanometer pump when we told the molecule to start coming apart and the 800 nanometer probe, which said measure the spectrum produced by this recombination. And what we see is that it goes way down and then back up again on a time scale of about 50 to 100 femtoseconds. And so this was kind of a puzzle. Then we realized that what we're seeing is quantum interference in the dissociating molecule. And from this, which I'll explain in a second, let's see the next one here. So what we think is happening here, so this is one bromine atom. This is the other bromine atom. There are many electrons here, but we're only really interacting with the valence ones. The red line is the de Broglie wavelength of this electron as it comes back. Remember I showed a sort of a plane wave picture in the movie? It would look like a plane wave coming back. And so this is the de Broglie wavelength of the electron at a particular time as it comes back. And if this side of the wave function is out of phase with this side of the wave function, which is given by this equation here, then I will expect to have a minimum in the recombination. And so if I simply plot where the minimum in time is here, which is related to the wavelength, I get a curve here, which tells me what the internuclear separation is here as a function of time delay, and agrees with our simple model on this. So this shows that this high harmonic spectroscopy can follow the dissociation of a simple molecule in time. High harmonic spectroscopy picture here, slightly more complicated molecule now, it's nitrogen dioxide. So this is a bent molecule, so it tends to bend back and forth like that. So now this is the problem again of plotting, because this is a 3D, the potential energy surfaces for a triatomic molecule are three-dimensional, and so we almost always draw them as a 2D cut. And so one of the degrees of freedom is the stretch, which is one of these bond lengths here. Actually, this is a symmetric stretch, so it's where the oxygens are relative to the nitrogen. What I don't show is the asymmetric stretch is where they do this. And the other axis here is the bending angle, and so it's this angle here. And most of the action occurs here when we excite again with 400 nanometers, fortunately. And it starts bending. And so we go from this ground state here, which is now 2D, up to here, which is the excited electronic state. And the probability, the nuclear wave function, which is the probability of where the atoms are, now starts falling down, but it crosses this surface here. And so population can hop onto the lower surface. So where these two surfaces meet is called a conical intersection. And this is something that quantum chemists love. They're a little bit hard to appreciate, but it's basically a point where two different electronic surfaces meet. But they're really important for a lot of things, like your first step of vision is involved with a conical intersection where a photon is absorbed and the energy, electronic energy, is converted to kinetic energy, which rearranges the whole rhodopsin molecule on a much slower time scale. And conical intersections are associated with why your DNA is not sensitive to UV and doesn't mutate as quickly as it might. So we followed very quickly. Again, here's the time delay between the pump and the probe. We see this modulation here, which was associated with population on these surfaces going up and down, which again has never been seen. This is very difficult to see in any other means, but we did see it with this high harmonic spectroscopy. This is my last one. So this is where we took a picture of a single molecular orbital wave function. So the units here, this is space, so x and y are in angstroms. So this is a spatial picture of what this wave function looks like. And this is a wave function, not an electron density, which is what causes a lot of controversy. So my scale here is both negative and positive. And so in the middle, it's negative, and on either side, it is positive. The nitrogen atoms are actually sitting at these lobes where the wave function goes through zero. This is a calculated wave function from a quantum chemistry package. And so you can see they're quite similar. We have things out here that are basically Fourier artifacts because we didn't sample enough in the experiment. And we did this by simply rotating the molecule and doing this high harmonic experiment. So take an electron away, comes back as a plane wave, recombines, but the recombination moment depends on the angle of the molecule, which I can do between from time to time. And I can then build up an image of what this wave function looks like using a tomographic approach to it. And this was highly controversial because the particularly quantum chemists, for some reason, they calculate these things all the time, but they say they don't exist. And so this has been great for citations. This brings me to a more general question about quantum mechanics. So this is part of a more general talk that I would give, is that in early 20th century, scientists thought they understood everything, right? We understood motion of planets, and we understood about electrons and protons, and they understood that the benzene molecule was a ring, and amazing things that they understood in those days, but they didn't understand atoms too well. And so these are some of the models that they had of atoms in the early 20th century. The Archeon and the Dynamid model, and my favorite, the Plum Pudding model. Sounds very, very English, doesn't it? Plum Pudding. Of course, these all got pushed aside by what we call quantum mechanics. And so this is another controversial statement, is quantum mechanics is considered to be the most accurate physical theory ever created. Where did this came from? It came from the internet, so it must be correct, right? So, well, we've also got Richard Feynman, who says nobody understands quantum mechanics, which gives me some relief. But just to give you an idea of the accuracy involved in quantum mechanical calculations, this is a paper from Gordon Drake at the University of Windsor of a helium atom. So this is the simplest three-body problem in quantum mechanics. And it is an extremely difficult problem to do it really accurately. But I just want you to look at the number of decimal places here. This is, I think, 38 decimal places. There are something like around 23 for most of these things. And so these people doing calculations are arguing over 23 decimal places in the accuracy about who is better.
This is the excitation energy?
No, I think that, well, that's a good question. I think this is the ground state energy, to be honest. But, yeah, I'm not. I only took the table just to show the number of decimal places. I mean, in a way, to me, this looks like resistance in ohms. I don't know what they're measuring. But the point is that quantum mechanical calculations are incredibly accurate, and I don't know, Alan, if there's something that's more. Like, I mean, you guys have Planck's constant. You stopped at, 12 decimal places or something? And
yeah, better than 10 parts per billion, so about half the number of decimal places.
Yeah, so. So I just wanted to talk about what the wave function means here. So this is Schrodinger's equation, you will call. I've got Planck's constant back in here again for some reason. And of course, there are relativistic versions of this. This is a Dirac equation. But you have a Hamiltonian, and I've seen somebody write this with the Hamiltonian of the universe on there. So there's a kinetic energy and the potential energy of every particle, and it's just a summation. You just sum over every particle in the universe. It's easy to write down, a little bit harder to solve. But the point is, this wave function is a function of position and time, but it's complex. And this is where the argument is, can you measure a complex quantity? I mean, often we think, you know, in electrical engineering or in physics, you do complex numbers to include phase and amplitude, but it's sort of a mathematical trick. And quantum mechanics, this is not a trick. It has to be either, you can separate Schrodinger's equation into two equations to get a real and imaginary part, but there are two parts to the wave function, one way or the other. So these guys came up with the what's called the Copenhagen interpretation, and one of them is Heisenberg, but I'm uncertain which one is which. So they didn't come up with this right at the beginning. It was much later in their careers when people were saying, well, what does this wave function mean? And they were sort of forced into coming up with this Copenhagen interpretation. This is the way we're taught, at least the way I was taught in there, that it's basically carved in stone, that the wave function determines the system, but the wave function is not an observable. Only the square of the wave function, which is a real number, is observable. And but the exit, the out here is that there are observables. You're allowed to make observations of a Hermitian operator, such as position and momentum and energy, and so on. Now, it turns out that there are many interpretations of quantum mechanics. So again, this came from the internet, so it must be true. So this is a table of different interpretations of quantum mechanics. So here's Copenhagen interpretation, but there's others. This is de Broglie and von Neumann, and there's many worlds and many minds, and there's a whole bunch of them here. And then there's the properties across here. And so one of them is the wave function real? And they don't mean real as in imaginary. They mean, does it exist? Does it have real meaning? And you'll see that, so Copenhagen says no, but there are many of the other ones that says this wave function really does exist and has real physical meaning in there. And so this is kind of like when you're buying a television or something like that. You just, you know, you look at all the properties here and you find the one with the most green and you choose, and that's the one you want to buy. So I think, I don't know, I think de Broglie wins on that one. Okay, so change of topic. I should get going here. So I want to talk about femtosecond frequency combs as an introduction to precise time measurements. And so I mentioned at the beginning that I would get to this. So this is a femtosecond oscillator. This is very much like the one we use. So there's a gain medium here, which is a sapphire crystal with a little bit of titanium doped into it. What I don't show is a green laser is coming through this mirror and exciting a very small region of this crystal, and is producing a population inversion. And so this is a cavity. There's a mirror on one end. We don't even use a saturable absorber. This is a plain mirror, and another mirror here. We need a prism pair in here to compensate for the group delay dispersion caused by the pulse going through here. Otherwise, the pulse, every time it goes through, we get longer and longer in time. And this thing mode locks all by itself and produces a series of pulses. And so if I just unfold this cavity, so now I have a gain medium here, and I have two mirrors, one of which doesn't reflect 100%. Every time a pulse goes through a round trip, it will come out and produce a little pulse. And they're separated in time by the twice the cavity length divided by the speed of light. And so this is, so the periodicity is given by, as I mentioned, the cavity round trip time, which is given a frequency nu zero. And so something which is periodic in time. So I've got this pulse followed by maybe 10 nanoseconds later by another pulse and another pulse. So it's periodic in time. And so this means from this Fourier identity here that it must be periodic in frequency also. And this gives us these frequency combs here. So these are the little red lines that I showed earlier. Well, no, not quite. No, they're not quite the same. They're related, but they're somewhat different. And so what this tells me is that the Fourier transform of a single one of these pulses, which looks like this is a real experimental one. If I zoom in, it's modulated by a bunch of delta functions at multiples of this this frequency here. So I only get these lines on the red lines that show up. And so this is a frequency comb, and it's given by the periodicity in time of my train of pulses coming out of this laser cavity. And so I mentioned that we can control the phase of the carrier underneath the envelope. And so there's two things. So if I match the period of this, the blue pulse, so imagine I replicate this blue one for thousands, millions of cycles, and I manage to put an envelope on the next one, then I've got a perfect replication of every pulse. And I can actually do that. So there's two things you can control in this frequency comb. So one is the separation between any of the two lines, and that's just the length of the cavity. So if you make your cavity a little bit longer, then these frequency combs get a little bit closer together. But the other thing is you can also shift this whole comb left and right, modulo this repetition frequency here. And that is given by the how much these pulses slip in phase. So if this is a cosine, and I make this a cosine, and then make that a cosine, then this will extrapolate back to zero. Typically, you don't. You want to have a slight offset in order to help the servo loop. But this now gives you a ruler, which goes basically from zero frequency all the way up to optical frequency. So now you can take some unknown frequency, or perhaps a really well-known frequency, and compare it to your frequency comb, and this gives you a beat note. When you put these two colors on your detector, of just a silicon photodiode, you will see an RF beat frequency, which you can measure very precisely, which tells you the difference, how much this green line is separated from the red ones. And so this, in metrology, is used to relate the cesium primary standard to, for example, optical sources, where there's a huge difference in frequency. But this ruler is that accurate that you can do that. And so this shows again, so this is a year again, from 1950 up to 2015, and this is relative accuracy, so that's 10 to the minus 15. So you can see how clocks have come down and down. But the advent of optical clocks and femtosecond frequency combs have a much sharper decline or increase in accuracy, just showing you how this technique works. So I should mention the femtosecond frequency comb is not a time standard. It is a ruler that is used to compare frequencies. I think my final... I'm almost done here, is some ideas about what sort of fundamental questions can be answered through time measurements. And so it's got a collection of a few papers that I just randomly picked up about coupling of fundamental constants using an optical lattice, measuring the frequency difference of two different atoms, a heavier and a lighter atom. So metrology did the 17th decimal place. So they measured this ratio of the frequencies of these two atomic transitions over a period of about a year. And you can see there's a bit of a slope on there. And so this is a ratio of the fine structure, the change in the fine structure constant. And this is the electron to proton mass ratio. And this is actually a little bit off zero, the change. So they claim over this experiment that they've seen a change in the fine structure constant over a year. And so the more accurate your clocks are, the smaller the change you can see over a period of time in human lifetimes. This is from Ted Hench's group, where they were measuring the size of the proton. which is, I think, in the order of femtometers. And apparently there is some controversy where the standard values for this are quite different from several measurements. And so this is their work on this optical clock. So this is a 2s to 4p transition in atomic hydrogen, for example. Ted Hench, I remember years ago, was the one that said he wanted to measure the hydrogen 2s to 1s transition, which is, of course, dipole forbidden transition. So it's got an incredible lifetime. And so it's really precise to measure that. So this is related to that. And the final slide is some stuff from our colleagues at the University of Ottawa, which is totally off the wall as far as I can see. So what they do, this Ibrahim Karimi uses what he calls vector light or light with orbital angular momentum. And so this is not a property of a photon, it's a property of a collection of photons in a beam. And the phase of this wavefront is like a spiral. So it sort of looks like a piece of twisted macaroni or something going through space. So they use this to encode single photon information. They transmit it between different buildings on the campus for a quantum key distribution. But he came up with this crazy idea that they can use beams of neutrons with orbital angular momentum and measure the radius, the charge radius of the components of the neutron using this experiment. So this was a conjecture, which again just shows some of the crazy ideas that may pay off in the future. So that's, I think I've got one more here. Yeah, just my summary of what is one RSC, what am I working on? What are frequency combs, and some rough ideas about precision experiments. So thank you very much.
So how do attosecond frequency combs compare? Have you tried to make an attosecond frequency comb?
Well, we kind of get them for free, these high harmonics.
Yes, exactly.
But
they're not that good.
They aren't, but so yeah, that's an interesting suggestion. So one of the improvements in clocks going from cesium at 9.1 gigahertz to strontium, where's Pierre, is whatever it is.
445 terahertz.
Okay, well, there's probably more decimal places there. is just the multiplier in frequency. So you've got that many more cycles in a period of time, and so it's more accurate. So then going from the visible to the extreme ultraviolet again multiplies this accuracy. So people are doing that, but it won't work with ours because we only have about 10 of these attosecond pulses in one of our femtosecond laser pulses. So what people have done is, Jun Yi at Jilla at NIST has a buildup cavity where he has a gas in the middle, so very much like our high harmonic thing, a little xenon gas, and then they keep feeding power into this cavity, and so this pulse is going through at the repetition rate of say 100 megahertz, but is producing much higher frequencies, and so they have extended the accuracy now going from visible to say 20 electron volts of photon. So it's another factor of 10. And so we at NRC, we had a proposal to do this in a piece of silicon, for example, have a build-up cavity because you can generate harmonics from solids too. And so that's as precise as the femtosecond pulse train that you're feeding in from your frequency comb source, but it's up-converted to the to the XUV.
Yes. There is one more comment. You can actually use a clock comparison to do a dark matter search. And there you don't look for a drift, you look for an oscillation in the ratio of frequencies of two different atomic clocks.
Okay, like the aluminum and mercury?
It depends on if you compare, let's say, two optical clocks. you would be sensitive to, in the ratio, what remains when you take the ratio is the fine structure constant, right? So dark matter candidate couples to the fine structure constant. And it's ultralight. We're talking about masses of dark matter that are way, way below WIMP dark matter. We're talking about masses that correspond to macroscopic wavelengths. Basically, you would have a dark matter candidate whose contour wavelength is the Earth's sun distance or something.
Okay.
Which there is nothing wrong with that, in a way. And so if you were to take, for example, the comparison of an aluminum and hydrogen and a mercury ion, that's sensitive to variations of the fine structure constant. So everything that couples to it will make it, if the dark matter couples to the fine structure constant, will make it oscillate. Or if you compare a microwave clock, cesium, to an optical clock like a terbium, then you would be sensitive to all sorts of, if you couple some dark matter to the proton mass, to the protons, to the electrons, and the fine structure constant as well. It's just that as you put there, cesium is not as precise. So you can do a dark matter search as well.
All right. So what is the period of the oscillation?
So the period set by the mass, because by the mass of the dark matter. Because at such low masses, you no longer think of dark matter. First of all, at such low masses, the dark matter cannot be a fermion anymore. It's only bosonic. So what happens, so usually you think of dark matter like the WIMP picture people have for dark matter is like particles moving around the galaxy. But in reality, quantum mechanics, as you showed, you shouldn't be thinking about point particles. You should be thinking about wave packets whose size is set by the de Broglie wavelength of the dark matter. Now, if the dark matter is very heavy, then it doesn't matter because the separation between the wave packets is so large, you can either think about it as a point particle, you think about it as a wave packet, it's all fine. But as you make the dark matter mass lighter and lighter and lighter, at some point the wave packets become so large that they start overlapping. In order for you to have the same energy density, you have to keep making the number density go up. And for fermions, of course, that's not possible because of Pauli's exclusion principle. In fact, there's a lower bound of fermionic dark matter candidate mass just from Pauli's exclusion principle, which is around 70 eV.
70
eV. So if you go over C squared,
which equals one.
So now if you have a boson, though, you can make it much lighter than that. There is a cutoff at 10 to the minus 22 eV over C squared, which is a contour wavelength of about a light year. And then at some point the de Broglie wavelength of the dark matter becomes so large that it doesn't fit inside galaxies anymore. So we cannot observe the structure. It cannot explain the structure that we see. And turns out that, so 10 to minus 22 is a period of a year. And atomic clocks can do periods as far, shorter periods up to a second, right? Because usually the interrogation time of an atomic clock is a second. I mean, you can think about how to go to higher frequencies by doing a pulse sequence that can show you higher frequencies. But usually this is the window of frequencies that it's sensitive to, variation it's sensitive to. It's like a nice coincidence, the 10 to the minus 22.
Well, the optical clock people will probably perhaps discuss that today, I don't know.
Yeah, so...
Can you have BEC?
What do you mean BEC? Well, so you have to be, for me, what does it mean to have a Bose-Einstein condensate? It means to have the ground state of a system in thermal equilibrium, of a system of bosons in thermal equilibrium. It is a classical field, can be described by the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, a classical field equation. But this dark matter candidate, so a BEC is a classical field, but a classical field is not necessarily a Bose-Einstein condensate. So the dark matter, probably it's not at the ground state of the galaxy, okay? So it's not formally, by the letter of the law, a Bose-Einstein condensate, but there is an analog of the Gross-Pitayevsky equation for that dark matter.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's on a slightly larger scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, but the usual thing.
maybe more analogous to a coherent state of field.
Yeah.
Like your laser beam. It's oscillating classical field configuration.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess we should have our next speaker. I'm running over.
Taking a break.
Oh, we're taking a break.
Because 11:30.
Thank you.